underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In his new book, Missoula, journalist John Krakauer investigates a spate of campus rapes that occurred in Missoula, Montana over a four-year period, documenting the experiences of five victims. Please be advised of the adult nature of this program. We do discuss rape and sexual assault. John Krakauer is the author of Into the Wild, Into Thin Air, and Under the Banner of Heaven. We welcome John Krakauer to this week's book show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Give us a sense of what brought you to the subject. My understanding is, as you detail it, is having a personal experience with someone who suffered, was the victim of a rape. What happened from there?
Once I saw how much she had suffered and how her life had been completely derailed by sexual assaults that had happened more than a decade earlier, I was shocked. This is someone with whom I'm very close, and I wanted to find out what had happened. And when I did, I was further shocked to find out how prevalent rape is and how people just don't want to address it, how much it's under the surface and kept that way intentionally. I didn't set out to write a book. I was well into my research for personal reasons when I decided to write this book. And that came about when I went to a sentencing hearing for a football player named Bo Donaldson, who had confessed to raping a woman named Allison Huguette. And when I saw her on the witness stand doing battle with a very aggressive, very obnoxious defense attorney, and she gave as good as she got, I was so impressed that I, in an intermission during the hearing, I asked if she would consider doing a book, and that's how it began.
Obviously, there are several campuses across the country, more than we want to realize, that are dealing with this issue. What was it about Missoula that was specifically interesting from a journalistic point of view?
I was looking at something like 30 different cities and schools in those cities that had serious rape problems, as most schools do. I picked Missoula as the subject because of Allison Huguette. I thought I could build a book around her. I just initially imagined focusing on this one sexual assault, kind of the natural history of a sexual assault. But when I started digging, Missoula turned out to be almost an ideal city. And that is because it's not an outlier. It actually, there are, you know, fewer rapes per capita in Missoula than many cities. It's pretty typical American college town. So, you know, the fact that this is happening in Missoula suggests strongly that it's happening throughout the country. And that's why Missoula turned out to be a good choice. I decided to do a book at some point after a lot of research, but it's still intuitive. You have to have the sense of this is going to be an interesting, complex, nuanced story. And that all turned out to be true for Missoula. I thought I was very fortunate in that I picked Missoula to be the subject of this book.
So let's talk about Allison Huguette and her friend Bo Donaldson. They grew up together. They graduated from high school together, but they did not go to college together.
They were best friends throughout childhood. She went to Eastern Oregon University, not too far away. He went to his hometown, you know, University of Montana. They both went to Big Sky High School. And she happened to be back in town in the fall, and they got together for a party at his house. There was some drinking going on. She was offered a place to sleep so she wouldn't have to drive home. And in the middle of the night, she woke up to feeling herself being raped by her best friend. And it's very hard to describe how traumatic that was for her, but it was extremely upsetting. And how she reacted was indicative of how many women react when they're raped by people they know and trust. And 85% of all rapes in this country are done by acquaintances of the victim. So this is not an atypical situation at all.
This is a big guy. This is a football player. He's 230 pounds. She's 130 pounds. At what point does she decide that she is not going to press charges?
She was really torn. You know, rape is so traumatic in most cases that it changes brain chemistry. I mean, scientific studies have shown this. And in her case, it was so complicated. So she decided, though, that she wanted an apology. She wanted him to acknowledge what he'd done. So she and her best friend arranged for Beau to come over the next day and be grilled by her. And what she didn't tell him was she hid a tape recorder in the couch. Mm. And at first he denied it, said, oh, we were just making out. It was consensual. And she was like, Beau, you're my best friend. Don't lie to me. And eventually, actually pretty quickly, acknowledged, you're right. But still, she didn't want to wreck his life. He persuaded her that morning that he would turn his life around. He had a drinking and drug problem. He didn't know why he'd done it. He had a girlfriend. And she believed him. And because she had this tape recording, she thought she had some leverage. She tried to pretend nothing had happened to her, that she didn't need psychotherapy. She went on with her life. And then a year later, she realized how angry. She started having fantasies of, you know, she asked a friend to beat Beau up. She had fantasies of killing him and slashing his tires. And she realized she needed to do something. She was angry all the time. And at that point, she got on the internet, contacted a detective she'd had some contact with earlier. And then, after further discussion with him, decided only then to report Beau. And one of her main motivators was that she realized, man, if he would do this to me and now he's not sorry, that he might be doing this to other women. And she said, I can't live with myself if he does this to anyone else. And for almost all the women I interviewed in this book, I think that was a motivating factor. They dreaded coming forward. They knew that they would be shamed publicly. They would be disbelieved. But they didn't want it to happen to anyone else.
Then you started to look at other cases, and as you just told us, Missoula is a fairly typical town, and their rate is a little less than the national average. That being said, in the four-year period of time that you looked at, 230 rapes in town. That is a staggering number.
And actually, when the DOJ, who eventually came in to investigate Missoula, the Department of Justice, they found that 350 sexual assaults against adult women had occurred during this four-year period. And the prosecutor had only prosecuted 14 of them, which is one of the reasons they were investigating the prosecutor's office, along with the police and the university. And that also is not atypical. Prosecutors are very reluctant to prosecute rape cases because they're so hard to win. They, like other lawyers, like to win. They keep track of their batting average, and they don't want to commit the considerable resources in terms of dollars and emotional capital. In this case, though, the prosecutor, who was a woman, Kirsten Pabst, who was in charge of the sexual assault division during these 4 years, she denied all these 336 other cases. She said there wasn't sufficient probable cause. This included evidence of signed confessions, a video of someone putting drugs in a drink. None of these things she considered strong enough to win a case. So prosecutors have incredible leeway. You know, they have no civil liability. They can't be sued for the decisions. If they decide not to prosecute a case, a victim has no recourse in the criminal justice system. She's out of luck. Or he. There's sometimes a man, although in my book, all the victims were women.
Was there an awareness on the part of the prosecutors and even in law enforcement that the numbers were as high as we were just discussing? And not only those numbers were so high, but that 97% of the rape cases, the rapists walked away.
Oh, yeah. Cops and prosecutors are very aware of how few rapists are held accountable. And I got to know some of the cops in Missoula who were good cops. They like to put bad guys away, but they become jaded. It's like, why should we bother doing all this work if the prosecutor's not even going to prosecute? Cops tend to be skeptical, cynical, old school, seat of the pants kind of guys who work hard, and they don't believe a lot of the modern science they've heard. They come into it with the same prejudices that most of society does. There's this false assumption in a lot of police departments that the rate of false accusations is around 40-50%, because there's been a couple of widely circulated studies that are bogus that say 40 or 50% of rape accusations are false. Well, in reality, really good studies show that the rate of false accusations is between 2-10%, probably the lower end of that. It's pretty much exactly the same rate of false accusations for other serious crimes. The only difference is, in rape cases, the victim is the one who's not believed, not the accused. And that's really different. The whole criminal justice system is set up to protect the rights of the accused against a very powerful state where prosecutors have a lot of power. In rape cases, it's different. It's the accused, an individual, against his accuser, and he has all these constitutional protections. She has none. In court, he has a huge advantage, and that's a large reason why only, you know, 3% of rapists are ever incarcerated. That's why only At most, 20% of rape cases are ever prosecuted. You know, 80% aren't even prosecuted. It's higher than that, actually. The best statistics are that only 5% of cases are prosecuted. So, you know, law enforcement just doesn't like rape cases. They're really tough to win. It's this vicious cycle where victims see what happens to other victims who report. They don't get any justice. They're shamed. They're humiliated. They're further traumatized in court. So, of course, they don't report. And this is a self-perpetuating cycle.
The book is now out in paperback. When it came out in hardcover, were you surprised by the controversy that the book stirred up, especially in Missoula, which I guess is not as much of a surprise, but that the debate it stirred and the fact that people were talking about your reporting methods versus the numbers that we were just discussing?
I wasn't surprised it was controversy, nor was I surprised. I was disappointed that my reporting was questioned. I mean, that was generated by Kirsten Papps, the prosecutor I just mentioned, this rogue prosecutor who wouldn't prosecute. I waited to the very end to try to interview her because it's not like a newspaper story that comes out the next day. My book wasn't going to come out for months, and I didn't want to give her a chance to derail it. So I didn't. I waited till the last, you know, week or two when I had still had time to interview her. And she did what I was afraid she would do. She refused to talk to me. She demanded that I put her in touch with my lawyer. And all she would tell him was that she was going to sue me for libel. Then she contacted my publisher, Doubleday Books, and threatened them with libel unless they halted publication. The defense lawyer, who's another villain in the book, who defended the accused quarterback who raped another woman, he and Kirsten Papps mounted, you know, this campaign in town. That old Krakauer never talked to us. He didn't talk to anyone. I didn't just interview a lot of people. I tried to interview the rapists. I interviewed victims. I interviewed cops off the record. I got a lot of records that I wasn't supposed to have. Montana has a very good press shield law, so I could do that legally. The accusation that I didn't do my research is nonsense. I was really careful to make sure not only did I have, you know, oral corroboration, tape-recorded interviews, but I had a paper trail. I got, you know, trial transcripts, hearing transcripts from the university, from police reports. You know, the proof was irrefutable. I mean, I filed a Freedom of Information request to the university over 2 years ago now, and I was shut down cold. I took it to court. I petitioned. I won the state case. Then the state appealed to the state Supreme Court, where it is now. But so on one hand, I've begged the university for records and information, and they just shut me down. They wouldn't even tell me if one of these hearings even took place. They literally had the gall then to say that I never interviewed them. I never interviewed the president. I didn't interview the dean who overturned the quarterback's expulsion. You know, it seemed rather disingenuous of them to say that, you know, well, he didn't do his homework, when I was doing everything in my power to find out what happened, and they were just stonewalling me. Yeah, I mean, I was surprised they took it to that dishonest level, but I expected pushback. Victims will tell you about pushback. Silence and shaming and denial are the tools of rapists and their enablers, their defense attorneys, politicians, university presidents, football coaches, football players. That's the nature of this. It, you know, it needs to be dragged out into the light. There are so many parties who are reluctant to do that. One of the things that makes me saddest is universities, they're supposed to be beacons of enlightenment. They're leading players in the covering up of how serious this problem is on campuses. They don't want to damage their university brands. They want those fresh-faced kids. They don't want their parents to know what's going on at these schools. They don't want their good name sullied. And that's a huge problem. We need transparency.
As you were writing this book, another story about rape on a college campus gained national attention. That was the story by Rolling Stone magazine about an alleged gang rape at the University of Virginia. The story has since been retracted. Did that case spook you at all?
It angered me. It didn't spook me. That happened in November of 2014. I was finished with the book. I was just fact-checking it. I turned it in a few weeks after that. And it really, I felt so bad. You know, the woman apparently lied, the alleged victim. And I don't know why. I'm sure it's a complicated story, but she didn't tell the truth. It was the responsibility of the reporter and her editor at Rolling Stone to have determined that and not publish that story. They could have, they should have, they didn't do their due diligence, and they damaged her. They gave all this ammunition to all these deniers who say, see, women lie. when we know that, you know, women don't lie about rape any more than they lie about other crimes. Certainly some women do lie, but the number of women who lie, it's infinitesimal. You know, 97% of these of people actually rape walk away without a care. 2 to 10% of women who accuse them are actually not telling the truth. So that's a problem, and we need to address it. I'm not saying they should get a free pass, but that problem is a much smaller problem, this huge problem of women who are brutally assaulted and damaged. They're traumatized deeply, sometimes for the rest of their lives. No one listens to them. No one believes them. That's the real problem here.
And I guess I use the word spooked when I ask the question, because it seems then, because there is so much lack of trust in the women who are telling these stories, that a case like the Rolling Stone story is ammunition for them at the exact time your book is coming out.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't worried about my book. I was worried about the whole... I'm trying to get people to talk about this and talk about it honestly and start speaking truthfully about it. And this didn't help that at all. It made, you know, people who don't have the time or the interest in looking into it just, oh, yeah, I heard about that Rolling Stone case. Women lie. I mean, that just, you know, fuels this misconception that most women lie when most women tell the truth. And that was really disheartening for me. It actually, you know, energized me. It made me want to, originally the book we had decided to postpone it, and then we moved it back to its original date in April. And part of the reason was, you know what, we need to not delay this. We need to get this out there fast. I mean, I was also accused wrongly of, you know, well, he rushed it into print. He didn't do his homework. That's nonsense. I did all my fact checking. Yeah, there will be errors in my book, small ones. There have been a couple that have been fixed in the paperback, but they're very minor. And there are always errors. The important thing is to address them and correct them. This book, I fact-checked this more carefully than anything I've ever done, and it was really, really solid. So the Rolling Stone thing was, you know, in some ways maybe it was good. It added to the conversation. It got people talking, and that's never a bad thing.
In that conversation... And obviously, you talk to the victims, in these five cases, women. What has your experience been in the past year about men and their understanding of the issue? Is it more problematic for them?
Most men don't want to believe it. I get emails and people forward me tweets of, I remember one tweet just recently from a student at the University of Montana who was, you know, Krakauer is a he's an a**hole because I missed half a day of study because I had to go to the stupid workshop about, you know, consent and that kind of stuff, because Krakauer's stupid, dishonest book. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I get a lot. There are certainly men who take this seriously, are grateful to be enlightened as I was when I learned of this problem. There's a lot of men like that. There's men who are organizing. I've heard from a number of men who are on their campuses, their fraternities are organizing groups to educate men, this effort to intervene when you see your friends taking advantage of a woman, when you see a woman who's too drunk to give consent. So there is good stuff happening, but there's so much that needs to be done. The roots of this problem are so deep in our society, in every society. It's not a new epidemic. This is a problem that's existed since the dawn of civilization. And, you know, it's shameful that it's still allowed to go on with a wink and a nod in so many universities and in so many places. And I have to say, I wrote about campus rape sort of coincidentally, but studies show that women who aren't in college are more likely to be raped than women who are. Not a lot more likely, but that's an even greater problem. And at least on campuses, the criminal justice system has shown that it is not up to dealing with this problem. But campuses have to, under law, make their campuses safe. So they are making a big effort now to try to figure out ways of adjudicating rape cases fairly. In New York State, your Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has a law she's trying to push through to make the standards nationwide and really make them effective and fair. And that's a huge thing. I hope that bill passes. She's got opposition. I don't know why this is a political issue. It shouldn't be. But for some reason, it is. Some reason, conservative Republican politicians, a lot of them think this problem doesn't really exist, or it's overblown, or that the real problem is men who are falsely accused. There is some bipartisan support for Gillibrand's bill. I hope there's enough for it to pass.
you started to investigate this, looking at the years 2008 to 2012. If we looked for 2012 to 2016, would the numbers be higher?
There will be more reported rapes, which is a good thing, because those are rapes that were always happening. But now that there's this bright light being shown on Missoula, people are reporting. The bad thing is that there's a study published at the University of Kansas last year that showed that when universities perform audits, when they're investigated, reporting goes up, they start addressing it. But then as soon as the investigation's done, it goes back to the old numbers, the old covering everything up. And that's not true with other crimes. The same as a control, this study looked at, well, what happens with other crimes, drug dealing, theft, that kind of stuff. Well, those numbers stay the same pretty much, whether the school's being investigated or not. But schools have such an incentive to cover this up. Institutional secrecy is this cancer. And it's especially true when it comes to sexual assault. And part of the problem is the U.S. Department of Education is at the forefront of trying to get universities to address the safety of their campuses to combat sexual assault. At the same time, they enforce a law called the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA. And FERPA has been misused, is misused by schools to cover up rapes on campuses. When I was asking the university for documents and records, they said, we're not going to give them to you because of FERPA. If we violate FERPA, they will cut off our $216 million of annual funding, which is nonsense. This law has been in place for 42 years, and not one school has ever had $1 taken away. So anyway, the Department of Education needs to recognize that FERPA is not really, I mean, I have a lawsuit in Missoula, Montana Supreme Court right now challenging FERPA. And if I win, and it's not clear I will win, but if I do win, it will set a precedent that could help overturn FERPA. And that will be a very good thing.
If that were the result, would you have more information available to you that you did not have?
Oh, yeah. One of the main stories in the book is about the quarterback, Jordan Johnson, star right. football player, the most popular guy in Montana, who was accused of raping a woman. That case didn't, it went to trial and he was found not guilty because of the burden of proof was so high. I thought he should have been found guilty. But anyway, the university also investigated the case. That was completely secret. I found out later that the university, he was found guilty in the initial investigation by the dean of students. That verdict was confirmed when he appealed to the vice president of student affairs. It was confirmed again in a university court where there was a hearing. His lawyer was present. He was present. He was expelled. The university court voted 7-0 to expel him. The university president confirmed that the hearing had been fair and did expel him. And yet he never left school. And then no one would say why, or even if he ever was expelled. And so those are the records I'm trying to get now. And it turns out the Commissioner of Higher Education overturned, reversed that expulsion. And I don't know the details. I want to know why. On what grounds did he reverse that? And that's important to know. Until we know what happens at these universities, it's not fair to either the accused or the woman accusing those guys if it's all hidden. It needs to be transparent. Until then, we won't know if these university processes are fair. We won't know anything. We won't know how prevalent the problem is, and it's so easy to cover it up.
And when you talk about prevalence, we also don't know how prevalent it is for that particular accused individual.
That's right. There is really good research that suggests that most rapes in society, not just on campuses, most rapes are done by a relatively small handful of rapists who on average have 6 rape victims each. They have other victims too, it shows. These same men typically abuse children. They do crimes of violence against women. So, when a cop says, you know what, this is just one rapist, she was drunk, he said, she said, too much, brain damage, we're not going to prosecute that. You're basically letting a guy who's probably raped many other women and will rape many more, you're letting him off the hook. You should be treating each of these guys as a serial predator who needs to be removed from the university, who needs to be removed from society. That should happen because that's the fact of the matter. It's not just some drunk frat boy who made a mistake. Most of these acquaintance rapes are very calculated. These guys choose their victims carefully. They use alcohol as a weapon or drugs to get them drunk or disabled. And then they strike. It's not just some blameless act. There's real consequences to this. Victims pay a terrible price. The trauma of being raped can often, creates post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, that can last a lifetime. The two largest causes of PTSD in American society are soldiers returning from war and men and women who have been raped. And the incidence among rape victims is higher than it is among veterans of our recent wars.
The name of the book is Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. It is published by Anchor Books. John Krakauer, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share this.
Again, the name of the book is Missoula by John Krakauer. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.